For the moment, the mediator is no more than a witness. Marveling be for these men and women who have found their Father, to carry God away in their soul, and whom God in turn carries away in his heart. Now that we have examined the mystery of the priest and his mission, it is time to consider what place the Christian family must give to the priest in their thoughts, devotions, and prayer. But isn't it up to you, rather than to me, to answer this question? What does a family think of the priest who often comes to visit them? There are homes in which the adults have a polite and easy manner with the priest which sometimes conceals their real opinion of him, but the children's attitude is revealing. There are other homes where he is received with a true cordiality, not very different, however, from the manner in which any good friend of the family is welcomed. Leaving them, he often experiences an uneasiness. They have called upon his human gifts and not his supernatural gifts. It is to his person, and not to the ministry of the Lord that they are attached. They do not have a true understanding of his priesthood. By contrast, when he reads confidence and respect in the direct gaze of the children, he knows that the parents have a profound comprehension of the priesthood and that they have inculcated it in their sons and daughters. In a farmer's home, the head of the family before the meal asks one of his three sons to express a welcome to the envoy of the Lord. In another home, the priest is invited to bless the table and to lead the evening prayer. As the priest departs from a professor's home, parents and children kneel for his blessing. If he has a closer association with these families, the priest will see that they follow with attentive sympathy the efforts of the clergy to establish the reign of Christ in the parish as well as in the mission lands, that they never miss an occasion to take the children to see a missionary depart or to be present at the profoundly instructive ceremony of an ordination, usually ignored by so many Christians. If he reads their hearts, he will discover that the fathers and mothers ardently wish that Christ come under their roof to recruit his apostles. It is a humble desire, with a certain resignation, for they well know that it is the choice of Christ and not that of the parents. But they also know that it is their task to create a climate where vocations can germinate and flourish. Perhaps one day they will have the happiness of receiving the first blessing from a newly ordained son. Then, kneeling before him, they will render homage to that higher paternity which has just invested the fruit of their love. When the priest leaves such a family to return to his apostolic task, he feels himself to be stronger. He knows that the retreat he is going to preach is sanctioned by them. He knows that the dangerously ill mother of whom he had spoken will be prayed for by them. They are associated in his ministry, and he in return adopts the family in his prayers and his mass. Because he knows that these families practice a Christian hospitality, the priest will not hesitate to send people to them: a catechumen who must be helped in his preparation for baptism, a lost person who will only find equilibrium in a healthy family, an engaged couple who seeks counsel. Often the success of his actions is precarious when they are not supported and completed by the devotions of a family. He fears for the new convert, the isolated young family, the vocation menaced by a hostile environment. To esteem, welcome, and aid the priest is good. But it is not everything. The families must also pray for priests, and most of all, for the parish clergy. Isn't it logical to offer this help to those who have consecrated their heart and time to you? Why is it that the faithful too often are estranged from their clergy, more prompt to criticize them than to serve? And when a priest fails, they are indignant. First of all, they should ask themselves what their part of the responsibility should be. Do they help him and protect him by their prayers? Do they ignore the fact that every leader is a man especially marked by the enemy? Still rarer are those who pray for their bishop, in spite of the invitation to do so in the memento of the Mass. They speak of him as a functionary, an administrator, yet he has received the plenitude of the priesthood. Almost everyone seems to ignore the fact that he is the spiritual head and father of the diocesan church, the authentic successor of the apostles, responsible for them before the Father. In conclusion, I ask you to remember always the Holy Father, the priest in whose face Catholics can contemplate the solicitude of all the churches. Jesus Christ, on the mountaintop, wept over the city. How often would I have gathered my children together, as a hen gathers her young under her wings. A similar sorrow tears the heart of the Pope as he regards a humanity divided and menaced by catastrophe. No one as much a father. It is December 20, 1950. The Pope has just entered into the Basilica, which is filled with the faithful. From my place I cannot see him. But at the rear of the church an enthusiastic cheering begins. He advances on his sedia. The hurrahs multiply as he approaches. I imagine him solemnly blessing the crowd with a papal gesture. Finally I see him. How could I have imagined him solemn and unmoved, this father who sees and hears, and I assure you he couldn't help hearing, these 45,000 faithful assembled from all comers of the earth. He bends to the right, to the left, extends his hands to those around him. This alive, eager, repeated gesture is almost impossible to describe. He at once greets, blesses, embraces, he welcomes all their sorrow, their appeals, and their hopes. He arrives near my place. I wish I could convey to you each feature of his face. A smile, as alive as his hands, as vibrant as his whole person, reveals his ardent paternal love. But sometimes a sudden expression of poignant gravity betrays how the terrifying responsibility with which he is invested weighs on his soul. Nemo tom pater, no one is as much a father, they say of God. After God, don't these words fit the Pope? No one is as much a father as he. And you to whom I speak know what the word father means, that four or five children are already a heavy responsibility for the heart of man. You must not only nourish them but lift them up, protect them against themselves, and against the evil which roams about the world. And there is no way to divest yourself of the burden. It is not simply on your shoulders, it is lodged in your heart. Contemplate the soul of this father whose children are counted in millions. In the evening at the family table amidst brothers and sisters recounting their day's exploits, calling to each other, interrupting each other, a young girl of pure heart, gifted with that marvelous power of perception which is the privilege of those who have no care themselves, fixes a steady gaze on her father's face, which seems graver than usual. A little girl cannot understand the secret agony of this man whose life is wasting away with a mysterious illness which the doctors refuse to name. She cannot understand. Nevertheless, when his eyes meet this softly insistent look, the father is miraculously relieved. The impression of terrible solitude in the midst of his noisy children is dissipated. Watching the Pope pass through the crowd cheering him, I thought, can there be a man more alone? Nowhere in the world could he find another man with a task the same as his, whom alone like himself God will ask to account for the whole human family. I wondered if at least occasionally his gaze did not meet that of some marvelously understanding soul. I hoped his always increasing family, aware of his prodigious mission, would not let him do prayer and penitence alone for the humanity which had been entrusted to him. When the ceremony ended, the Pope remounted the sedia and passed down the long central nave. At the end, the sedia was halted and turned halfway around. The Pope stood to give his blessing one last time, a small white silhouette dominating this sea of humanity. When I saw him extend his arms in this expressive gesture so characteristic of him, I understood how one must always be crucified to bless, that the Holy Father is not only the representative of Christ among us, but that in him Christ prolongs his passion for our sake. Virginity. Vocations, and notably feminine vocations, are becoming rarer. Virginity, that very pure homage of humanity to the transcendence of God, is losing its prestige. Is this due to all that has been said and written on the Christian grandeurs of love and marriage? Some think so. If I thought so, I would close up shop. But a consecrated life and a married life are not two opposite, contrary and competing realities. They are marvelously complementary, and the truly Christian families know this very well. Doubtless the young family has some difficulty remembering the superiority of the dedicated virgin and celibate, but the Church has never ceased to point it out. It is normal that the young husband and wife should meditate first of all on the wealth of the sacrament of marriage. Seek them out 15 or 20 years later, and if their love has survived the rude test of time, it will be the same and yet different. The springtime fervor, that almost foolish enthusiasm, is gone. The joys and sorrows experienced together, the laborious apprenticeship, the giving of self, the uphill struggle, have markedly matured them. They are more or less peaceful and strong. Were we to open a conversation about virginity, we would be struck more by the tone with which they speak of it than by what they say. It is almost as though their union were allied to virginity. It is even more notable that their love had to open itself to the charity of God to grow, to surrender to its purifying and transforming action. There is a mysterious affinity between their love and virginity, which is the triumph of divine charity. Despite its vagueness, affinity is the word which seems best to me. But it is not all easy to analyze what this affinity is. First of all, it is a feeling of security, a light in the dark. If it is missing, the couple would give the impression of being abandoned, and that hope had escaped them. For they know the tribulations of the flesh. And so this luminous presence of virginity in the Church is necessary and helpful in defending them from discouragement, assuring them that the Spirit aided by grace can triumph over the flesh. No, you don't hear families question the value of the celibacy of the priest. The life consecrated to God seems to them to be at the same time a hope and a pressing invitation to union with Christ. They know enough about life to understand what is essential. Certainly they do not regret being in the married state. Their vocation was not to go to God by the more direct route of virginity. But the time has come when the love of Christ, His unique grandeur, His primacy, has a new clarity for them. It is not a question of loving less, one never loves too much or enough, but of loving Christ first and above all, and others with the heart of Christ. A hope and an invitation of love still exists outside the family. For virginity is present at the very heart of love. Love aspires to virginity as the plant aspires to flower, or the tree to bear fruit. If one of their children tells them one day that he has been called by God, the mother and father are not tempted to regard it as a disavowal of the vocation of marriage which they hold in such high esteem. Rather, they see there a confirmation. The tree that bears good fruit is good. Marguerite Sarto, a peasant used to hard work, and the mother of the future pious X, well understood this. One day her son, consecrated a bishop, came to pay a visit under the humble family roof. He showed her his episcopal ring. "Look, Mama, at the beautiful ring they gave me." "That is true, my son, but you would not have had yours if I had not had mine," she said, kissing her old wedding band. No, marriage and virginity are definitely not two contrary, competing vocations. There is no need to exalt the one above the other. And I believe those who present the true role of Christian marriage, its grandeur, and its exigencies to our generation work hard for the honor of virginity. Married lives which do not betray the honor residing at the heart of love are fountains of virginity, wrote Coventry Patmore. Mary and her vocation. Woman is unimportant in history, they say. This is a very superficial view. It is true that the great names of history, conquerors, empire founders, and chiefs of state are almost always men, and that the history of politics, diplomacy, the military, economics, literature and art appear as the work of men. Just the same, if one looks to see who inspires, sustains and stimulates them in their passions, ambitions, enterprises and conquests, woman has a primary and often decisive role. But there is another history, the great religious history of humanity. Here women play a leading role. Two figures dominate, even Mary. An act of the first had turned history away from its source.